Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And how are you guys doing out there? Do you have a good weekend? Did you get out the grill? You do some stuff for the old Labor Day holiday? Or did you have to go to work? Honestly, if you had to go to work, that's fine too. You know, there's nothing wrong with putting in a day and earning a little coin. Earn a little coin. I don't talk like that. What am I doing here? You know, clearly I think these intros out like pretty heavily before they start, right? That's what enables me to lob out old chestnuts like earn a little coin like some kind of idiot. You know, if that hasn't been made completely clear to you by now, that all of this is just me flying by the seat of my pants with what makes sense to me. I hope it's clear now. I'm leaving this intro. By the way, on that topic, if you do need actual therapy from somebody, this podcast is not going to help you. This podcast is not a replacement for therapy for those who need it. It's more like hanging out with a guy who's trying to get you to hear his dog say, "I love you." You can have a conversation about it, and you might even have some thoughts about what he's doing. And some other people might have some thoughts, and you might even learn some things about yourself you didn't want to know. But here we are. And that's what this is. It's just an interesting conversation, and I'll let you decide how interesting it is. See, again, what in the hell am I talking about? Now, today on the show, we have Chris Rybitsky. He is an entrepreneur. He is a former Air Force musician. He is a current civilian musician in a couple of bands, including The Unfriended, my favorite punk rock cover band in Denver, Colorado, as well as a little outfit you may be familiar with called Decatur, which you can find at decaturrock.com. End of plug. But we have a really interesting conversation. Now, here's the thing. When I get to know people sort of semi-socially, I don't ask a lot of questions. I don't ask questions about, you know, where are you from? What was your childhood like? What do you do for a living? I don't think to ask these things. I tend to just sort of meet people where they are and ask questions that crop up in the moment. And so, having said that, I've known Chris for a couple of years now, and we get into this conversation, and there are things that I got out of this conversation that I had absolutely no idea about. And I really didn't know what to expect. We kind of just ran the gamut. He said he would talk to me. And that's enough. I think that every human being on the planet has an interesting story if you let them tell it. And so that's what we're going to do today. I'm going to hand this thing over to Chris Rybitsky, and we're going to have a conversation. And you're going to learn some things. And I'm going to learn some things right along with you. And maybe I'll actually even write an introduction one of these days. But, you know, I kind of like these things flying off the cuff. I do them at different times of the day. Sometimes they're in the morning. Sometimes they're at night. This one just so happens to be Thursday evening after I've been awake since 4 in the morning. And I'm exhausted. So you're getting something a little weird. I'm going to shut up at this point. And thank you for tuning in. I don't have enough nice things to say about this, so I'm going to close my mouth before I say anything absolutely terrible. Let's talk to Chris Rybitsky. Welcome. How's it going, man?
It is going well.
Yeah.
As always, you know, well, I shouldn't say that. That's not true. I mean, there's always the ups and downs. But sure. Today was a fantastic day. I actually got out and played 9, which is only my third round. And it's not even a round. It's like a half a round this year.
Oh, man.
Yeah, yeah, well, I haven't gotten out much, but it was nice. It was a gorgeous day. And Denver is always, you know, a lovely place to...
Yeah, I mean, you got to love Denver, Colorado, yeah. Especially lately. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. The smoke that we've had in the air from all the wildfires, making everything turn gray. The mountains are off in the distance, and you can't see them.
No.
It's just a gray wall in the sky. And so when that finally cleared, it was like, you know, Prozac from Jesus. You know,
yeah,
it was
yeah, just no, like, no, agreed. I mean,
oh, thank God.
When the smoke was there, you know, I don't have allergies or anything, but it was really affecting, you know, I'd wake up in the morning and have to blow out, you know,
yeah,
chunks, basically. And it's, I'm glad it's gone.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate where it's coming from. And, you know, I can't even imagine what it's like to be in an area that has such a, like a ginormous fire. It's
yeah.
Let's call it what it is.
Exactly.
Right?
Well, and the small fires are fine. I mean, that's basic land stewardship 101.
Right.
You have to let some of this stuff burn itself off. The problem is we're expanding more and more out into these wide open territories, and it's pushing all of that dry brush back in.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's more concentrated pockets of it than there would be. And we can't let these fires go because they're not going to stop themselves. And that problem is only going to make itself worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
So we know where the smoke is coming from, but let's talk a little bit about you. Where do you come from? Like, where's...
So I'm basically an East Coast person.
Yeah.
I was born in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Grew up there in a small hamlet called Old Forge, which, by the way, is the self-proclaimed, I have to underscore that.
Yeah.
Pizza capital of the world. We can talk about that a little later.
There's New Yorkers just like pissing themselves right now.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, no.
Go fuck yourself.
But then moved to New York when I was, what, 3-4 years old?
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere around there. And grew up in New York. Great times. Loved the East Coast.
Totally.
At one point, though, I migrated down south. I lived in New Orleans for a while. Went back to New York, lived in San Francisco for a while, you know, came back to New York, and now I'm here in Denver. But I'm pretty much an East Coast person as far as the family. I come from a large Polish and Italian family, so it's very close-knit. And
yeah.
Always
absolutely.
Has been.
I mean, yeah. Polish-Italian family
I was Catholic by fucking birth, too.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you can almost draw lines to all of these things.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And also, look at that time period. I mean, you would have been grown up, what? I mean, the 60s and 70s had to have been insane for you.
You know what? I had a really enjoyable, memorable time.
Yeah.
As a kid, right? So, you know, everything's not always like rainbows and unicorns, but my memories of like the 70s.
Yeah.
Pretty much defined by songs.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I can remember the songs that I heard during the summer. Like one group I remember was huge when I was, you know, that small was Wings.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't the Beatles. And don't get me wrong, I love the Beatles, but... I remember the songs of Paul McCartney in Wings, not necessarily the Beatles.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it was a good time, you know.
But that was another time entirely. I mean, that was a time when, you know, music had a much different delivery system.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Our relationship to music was also a lot different because our access to information was different.
Oh,
so
yeah.
If you really
huge.
Wanted to hear, you know, some kind of rare bootleg, you had to hunt it down.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to hunt it down physically.
Yeah.
If you wanted to know who are the members of the band, you had to read the jacket. You had to try and guess some sort of meaning from some of these
you
artists.
You were into the music that
yeah.
you were into.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I don't know about you, Chris, but when I got exposed, so I didn't start playing bass until I was, what, 10 years old?
Mm-hmm.
I started with woodwinds. And the only reason I started playing any instrument was I was jealous of my sister because she was a, we were both walkers to our elementary school.
Yeah.
And every day she'd walk home with that Bundy clarinet case, and I was like, I want one of those.
Yeah.
So that's why I started playing music, just so I could have a case like hers. But when I started playing bass, a friend of mine turned me on to Kiss and Rush at the same time.
Right.
And then I realized, oh, this could be really good. But yeah, but it was different at that time because, like you said, you had to pay attention to liner notes. Liner sure. notes actually meant something, right?
Skipping to the next song was a little more arduous than you're going to get now.
Exactly, exactly.
You had to know where the needle dropped on the record, or you had to be really gifted with a cassette deck, like to just skip to the spot. Oh, you know? That's where mixtapes came in.
Well, very true. Or even with albums. I mean, I can remember putting our fingers on an album to slow it down to learn a lick. So you'd get to that section, and you knew exactly where on that album that was, and you'd put your little pressure on that album as it was spinning around, and hopefully you can get it an octave lower so it's actually in the same key that you're trying to learn it in.
Right.
But that's how you'd learn, like, fast licks.
Yeah.
Slow it down. Yeah, I thought it was the most amazing thing when, I don't know who it was, Tascam, Fostex, or somebody like that, came out with a cassette player that you could actually set the speed to half speed.
Yeah.
And then learn the lick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a whole other time.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's not like, you know, God bless, and I say that very generally.
Sure.
For, you know, the kids that have the exposure to the technology that we have today. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
You know, sure, I'm going to do half speed, and it actually sounds the same, but half speed, you know, Audacity and all these other things that you can just get for free.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You know, good for them. I mean, I'm actually happy about the destruction of the music industry, and I put quotes around what I just said.
Sure.
You know, there's benefits, there's certainly, you know, not so great things about it, but at the same time, creative freedom. You're not bound by anything anymore.
Well, right. I mean, you know, it used to be that there were these gatekeepers that were kind of holding everything in a position. And it didn't matter how talented you were. It didn't matter how good you were. It didn't matter how long you had practiced, what kind of fan base you had. If you couldn't get past these gatekeepers, you know, that was it.
Yeah.
That was the end of everything.
You're not in, right?
Yeah. And now you almost don't need that anymore. You know, there's still some benefits to distribution and things like that.
Oh,
honestly,
oh sure.
But,
oh, yeah. I mean, that's just the business aspect of it. But
yeah,
I think
to be able to put your music together and get it out there to an audience, people have more options now than they ever had.
For the pure creative process.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right? So if don't equate the pure creative process, though, to success.
Sure.
Because the success side of it still requires the business acumen.
Well,
and
yeah.
And you know what? But that stuff is findable. It's searchable now. You can go to Google and find out contracts. You just want a template contract for what you're doing.
Sure.
So like if I said to you, Chris, I'm like, I want you to do a voiceover on something.
Right.
I could give you a release form that I downloaded 10 minutes ago by searching for legal release of rights. That's
yeah.
it. Done.
Well, that's what I did for the podcast. I mean,
oh yeah, I got to sign that.
You know, yeah. You know, you can sign it after. You
okay.
know, if you're comfortable with what we talk about.
Oh no, I'm good. I'm good.
So just backing up a little bit. You're growing up in New York.
Yeah.
You start playing the bass guitar. You're kicking around. So what was your first indication that? You know, maybe you weren't processing things the same way as the other people around you.
It was eighth grade.
Yeah.
I remember it distinctly. So let's see, you know, through K through 12, had a normal childhood, nothing to report, you know, no fights, got along with everybody. It was kind of good. And it was eighth grade Well, actually, you know what? Actually, going back, it was seventh grade where I realized that, like, bass was not an instrument to write music on.
Yeah.
You know, so totally into the instrument. Like I said, you know, when I started playing when I was 10, it was great. But then I realized that I wanted to make a statement, mm-hmm. right? So I would say that's number one recognition right there, is just as a kid saying to myself, I want to be out in front.
Yeah.
And putting yourself out there is not easy, right?
Right.
You know, and it's easy to have the cognitive realization that, yeah, that's what I want to do. And then when you start doing it, that's when you get your balls kicked in. It's, yeah.
Right.
It's like, oh, you want to put yourself out there? Oh. And I have to state for anybody listening, I'm a child of the 80s, the 70s, and the 80s. So I'm going to say some things that may be offensive. Get over it. Right? But that would be where you'd get the feedback as a kid, is like, oh, you're gay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, you're gay. And doesn't mean homosexual. It's just that was the vernacular, right?
Yeah, that was, I mean, you know.
But I realized
fucking that meatheads didn't know any better, and that was the easiest way to get to somebody at the time.
When, you know, when I was in seventh grade, that's when I really took an interest to the, you know, the female side of our wonderful species. And I was like, can't write a song on a bass.
Yeah.
And I actually tried playing guitar for a while, but my fingers at that time, you know, my young little fingers were used to the fatness of a bass as far as the spacing. Mm-hmm. So I tried a guitar, and from a string instrument perspective, it didn't work out. But then I said, you know, I should probably teach myself how to play piano. So, like, the first song I played on the piano in seventh grade was, you know, I'm going to keep on loving you. Good old Aria Speedwagon, right? Sign of the times at the time. But coming to eighth grade, I had actually started my first two bands. One was a Rush cover band. And we got a lot of accolades for the fact we actually played Rush. I mean, Hemispheres. We were like Caress of Steel. We did a gamut of their catalog. And then I was also in a Pat Benatar cover band. And I fell in love with the female singer. I mean, still a good friend of mine today, but
yeah.
At the time, it's like, oh, I love her.
Right.
But that's also...
Who doesn't love Pat Benatar? Like, even a fake Pat Benatar.
Exactly. But that's where I realized that, you know, I wanted to be out. I wanted to be out there. And it came with its challenges because, you know, Chris, you've known me now for, what, almost 3 years, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I have a very energetic personality. Let's just put it that way. At the time, I really wanted to push the band. So, like, one of the first moments of embarrassment in my life that I can really, like, resonate with, that made me, like, introspective about how I'm acting.
Yeah.
Was the first dance that we played at. So we got to play for our spring, you know, junior high school dance, and the drummer and, you know, who was coming with him were late.
Mm-hmm.
And I started berating them. No, you know, I'm 13 years old.
Right.
So you put that in perspective. But I realized that my personal struggle, going back to your original question, my personal struggle, it was the desire to be out there in front and present and looking to just, you know, fucking wow people. At the same time, the embarrassment of how crass and crude that I could be.
Yeah.
And it made me feel bad. And like, to the point of, like, cycling through my mind past the experience. Like, so even to this day, you know, I'm 51 years old now, right? But
yeah.
Even to this day, I find myself reflecting on my behavior. And sometimes it does make me feel bad, and it does bring me down a path. I'm not a perfect individual. Like, you know, no one's a perfect individual.
Sure.
But, you know, if you want, like, my personal struggle, it's the dichotomy of being so bold and forceful at the same time then taking it back later.
Yeah.
And, like, what did I just fucking say?
Right.
Was that you know, was that callous? Was that crude? Was that harsh?
Well, I mean, there's that struggle with, you know, beating yourself up over things.
You know, and I always do. As much as I exude confidence.
Sure.
The amount of time that I spend in self-reflection against the confidence, I don't know if it's a healthy balance sometimes.
Yeah.
You know? Because it does make me feel, and, you know, my natural reaction is then just to kind of clam up and say, okay, I'm not going to pay attention to what just happened.
Right.
I'm not going to address it. Because if I address it, then I'm going to look like, you know, of an asshole.
Well, yeah, once I address it, then we've got to talk about it.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a real thing. And, you know, maybe if we just ignore it, it'll just go away and it'll pass.
And if somebody brings it up to me, I'm happy to discuss it, but I wasn't the catalyst for it.
Yeah. So I mean, you're playing your music. You're starting to come into yourself. Mm-hmm. You're recognizing that you've got this aggressive, forceful nature with people. I mean, is that something that you felt like was outside of the norm of the people that you were hanging out with? Or was that something that everybody else that you were with was like?
No, it wasn't. I mean, I can illustrate it this way. I wasn't the perfect student. Now, I'm not going to lie. I know I'm an intelligent person. I know that my intelligence has actually, you know, been able to propel me to certain levels. But back then, you couple the intelligence with cockiness.
Yeah.
And I was more cocky than being intelligent. I would walk into a classroom, Chris, and if I didn't like the teacher or I, you know, had a particularly bad week.
Yeah.
Say it was a test. I'd put a zero on the test and I'd walk out. And my justification was I graded myself. There it is. I'm done. I don't respect you enough.
Right.
And, you know, so back in my day, you used to have hall passes to go certain areas,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, not to make this sound like 1950s, 60s Greece or anything like this, but we would steal hall passes and we'd be able to forge signatures. Back in, it was about eighth, ninth grade.
Yeah.
I would forge passes to go to the music room. I would literally spend 4 hours a day in the music room. And to this day, I'm always surprised that how could you not call me out for that? Why is Chris just hanging out in the music room? But that was the case. And I flunked in ninth grade. I had to repeat ninth grade.
Yeah.
And that, you want to talk about a soul crushing mental defeat is feeling that you are different than everybody else, but on a good side.
Yeah.
But yet, from the peer perspective, you just failed ninth grade.
Right.
I literally, well.
Yeah, because how do you take those two ideas and hold them at the same time? Like, I'm smarter than a lot of you, but I failed.
I just failed.
Yeah.
I just failed. And it was soul crushing that summer. Because in New York State, they have regents. They're part of the Regents program. So you had to pass at least the minimum Regents courses to graduate.
Yeah.
You know, there was obviously other factors, but Regents played a big part of it. And I failed my algebra Regents by 2 points, 63. And I pleaded with the teacher to give me a break. But I was such a dick to her for the entire year.
Right.
And in fact, I don't remember her first name. Mrs. Deshone, and I apologize to you on the public airway right now, but she was like, nope.
Yeah, of course.
And then, so I had to repeat ninth grade. And the craziest part of it was I only had to repeat two Regents courses that second year of ninth grade. So everything else was then literally filled up with either I'm in the music room or I'm in two art classes.
Yeah.
I had to fill up the day and the only two classes I had to repeat. But, it, you know, dude, it was soul crushing. It really was. I mean, if you want an event that probably shaped some of my perspective today and some of my, you know, emotional responses to how I react to things, it was that ninth grade. I still don't like talking about it.
Were you aware enough at the time to learn anything from it, or has all of the learning come later?
No, at the end. So at the end of that first iteration of ninth grade, I realized how bad I fucked up, and there was no relief.
Yeah.
There was no coming back. I just had to do it. I had to do it again. And it was a fairly emotional time for me and the way I behaved at that time over the summer with my family. I mean, the next year, I was still so angry about it.
Yeah.
My parents actually deemed me an incorrigible child. So yeah. I was forced into, I shouldn't say forced, but it was court ordered that I go to counseling.
Really?
That was the first experience. And to this day, I look at the experience as favorable.
Yeah. But
at the time, the way that I processed it was very hostile.
Yeah.
You know, and I wasn't, you know, I wasn't, a violent anything. I wasn't a bully. I wasn't anything like that.
Sure.
But being told that, you know, literally my parents went to the county court and said, he's incorrigible. And then a judgment was made.
Yeah.
It
sounds like there were people who were, you know, looking out for you in spite of yourself.
Right. I was destructive. I really was.
Yeah.
Both mentally and behaviorally.
Yeah.
I wasn't doing things that were smart.
Well, I mean, you were a smart kid. You picked up things pretty quickly, and you managed to get yourself out of just about any situation because you were smart. And then you find yourself in a situation where, you know, you've always skated by because you've always been smart enough to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it didn't work this
time.
No,
no, no. I colossally failed.
Yeah.
I failed. But I didn't want to recognize it.
But if it's been your experience your entire life up to that point, that, you know, well, that just doesn't happen to me. Like, how do you process that the first time? Of course you're going to process that poorly because you haven't spent a lot of time building up the skill set that, you know, less intelligent people have to deal with every day.
I think, Chris, you hit it on the nail. It's the way I processed it is like, I can't believe this is happening, but fuck it. I'm going to keep it going. Right?
Yeah.
Because that's the immaturity.
I have control over it now. So if I'm going to be perceived as a failure, I'm going to show you.
I'm going full bore.
Yeah.
That's what happened. And, you know, I'm not going to lie. I've had experiences like that even as an adult.
Yeah.
I think there's an innate, you know, part of your human nature.
Mm-hmm.
That you grow into, right?
Yeah.
And it's based on, obviously, experiences. But I also think there's some hardwiring behind there.
Sure.
Because even now, you know, clearly much more mellow as an older person than I was. But I have had situations where I'm like, okay, you want to push it? I'm going to push it.
Yeah.
And it sometimes works out to my favor. I would say more often not, it doesn't. But I struggle. I'd like to think, you know, I'm a wiser, older person, right? For my age, I'm like, you know, I have the experience and I have the perspective, and I think that's important, right?
Yeah.
But there is still something that I struggle with to this day where on that 1% of the time, I'm going to be like, I'm going to push it to the edge. Let's go.
Yeah. What do you think? Where do you think that comes from? Do you think that's fear or do you think it's anger?
I think it's a combination of both. Fear, if I would classify fear in this context, fear would be under the auspices of I don't want to come off as somebody who can't push back.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, totally.
So if you want to call that speaking your mind, whatever. Anger? Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I think I have a pretty tough skin, but sometimes even the toughest of skins can be penetrated.
Yeah.
And if you hit on a certain nerve, I may be, you know, again, I'm not, it's not a physical thing, right?
Sure.
It's a mind chess thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, you think you're going to check me? I'm going to checkmate you by cutting off all the heads of all the pawns in front of you, and I'm just going to stab you in the heart, you know?
Right. Well, but that's where intimidation comes in.
Yeah.
I mean, intimidation comes from anger, and it's not an outward physical threat. You know what I mean? It's not a physical thing, but if you're able to be intimidating, you are exuding your force out there. It's almost like it's almost like holding a remote control for the Death Star in your hand. You know, like, I'm not actually going to fire it, but I want you to know that I have it.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I think that's part of it. And I have to say that I'm not happy when things go that way. Well, and going back to that whole reflection thing I was talking about earlier.
Right.
You want to talk about a loop that goes in like a really negative way when I do have, you know, situations that happen like that and then have to reflect on it.
Yeah. Because
it makes me feel, you know, I wouldn't even closely or remotely call myself an empath.
Sure.
But I do feel, I really do have a genuinely, you know, large capacity to, you know, absorb the sensory input from around me.
People, sure.
Right? So when somebody feels sad, I get it. When somebody feels happy, I get it.
I think everybody does have that to a degree. There's a handful of sociopaths out there.
Yeah. Well, I certainly, you know, speaking of that, I'm not a sociopath, but I do have psychopathic tendencies. I mean, for what I do for business and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and
you almost have to be wired that way to succeed in business, quite
frankly.
It does.
I mean, like, egotistical tendencies.
Sure.
Sure. Raise my hand. I got it. And I'm aware of it. You know, it's not like if you came up to me and said, hey, you exhibit psychopathic tendencies, I would probably say, yeah, you're absolutely correct.
Yeah.
You've won today's prize.
And what are you going to do about it?
But no, it's not on that level, but it is.
No, I know.
You know, it's a very aggressive persona.
Yeah.
Not necessarily aggressive style, but persona. And, you know, would I classify myself as a narcissist? No. But egotistical? Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, they're two separate things.
Yeah.
Completely separate things.
But going back to the self-awareness, those are the cycles that when I have my downtime, when Chris finds himself just thinking in the quiet of the night, everybody's asleep. How was your day, Chris? What did I do? There's times like that.
Yeah. And I have that exact same thing.
Yeah, it's the struggle. So, you know, I know you've been very open about your, you know, bipolar struggles and what you're doing. And by the way, congratulations. I really do applaud you for recognizing, you know, therapy is a tool that you might want to look at least for discovering new tools within the toolbox.
Absolutely.
Because I've done the therapy thing too. And so here goes back to the fucking egotistical style. I've gone to therapy and I'm like, when I go into there, I'm like, I'm anticipating the questions you're going to ask me because I'm smarter than you.
Right.
That is eighth grade again.
Yeah.
Right. Going back to that. But yeah, it is for me the struggle, even to this day, is the retrospective, because I can go down so many rabbit holes that sometimes it's truly unproductive.
So how did your parents deal with that? I mean, obviously they got a judge involved.
Other than going to the court.
But I mean, how do you know what I mean? Like, how do they handle when they've got a kid whose brain is up to 11 and, you know, the rest of the world might be operating at a 6 or a 7 on a good day?
Chris, it happened later. It happened later in life. So as I matured into the adult. So after high school, you know, I contemplated college and I realized that I just don't have the focus to do that. And I ended up enlisting in the United States Air Force, and I became a member of the United States Air Force Band, and I was a staff arranger composer, and I also played bass in the rock band.
Yeah.
And it was that experience that truly imparted some discipline. Yeah. And I want to be clear about, like, the Air Force band against other military bands. And this is by no means, I'm not denigrating any military band. But in the Army, Navy, Marines, the bands are secondary to the core mission of, you know, soldier, seaman, Marine, right?
Sure.
The Air Force had a regulation that you were in the band. That was your primary mission. So doing anything else, and certainly I'm not taking away from anybody who's, you know, served our country proudly and, unfortunately, maybe in the field of battle. But the Air Force Band had a regulation that said that you're a musician. That's what you do for us.
Yeah.
And since I didn't have my undergrad at the time, they put you through a rigor that's not the same, because they actually do require that you have at least a bachelor's degree in music performance or music composition or education.
Sure.
If you don't, like, I had to go through like 4 rehearsals at 4 different locations to get, hey, you're good enough to play. So, it wasn't until then that I realized that, education was important. And maturity was important. I think the first, going back to when did I realize I was being a dick? That's my words, not yours, obviously.
You're still waiting to realize that?
Oh, yeah. I was cocky as hell. So, I got into the audition, and so you go back to your question about my parents and all that, right? So I go in there and I have my first it's the equivalent of what's called a jury in college. A jury is, you do a performance that you show a certain proficiency at a certain level.
Yeah.
Similar things in the Air Force. And I totally just, blew it off. I was supposed to learn like 20 jazz standards. Things like Autumn Leaves and Desafinado and things like that, right?
Yeah.
But you have to show proficiency in certain scales and arpeggios and all that thing. And you have to perform a solo piece. And I totally blew it off. Like, I'm God's gift to the bass, and I'm not. But, and I got called out so hard. Going back to the retrospective,
yeah.
This one actually made me cry when I left the room.
There's nothing like getting chastised really hard by grown ass men.
And still to this day, one of my good friends and mentors, Bob Misimko, incredible woodwind player. He looks me right in the eye and he goes, "Chris, you just stepped on your crank, right?" He goes, "That was literally garbage and a waste of our time. So you have 2 weeks to get your shit together."
Wow.
"Or we're going to have a conversation after that." And that was a wake-up call. That's when I realized. So going back to the original question, that's when I realized what a dick I could be and how I am lacking humility and humbleness for people that actually care not only about their craft, but here was the wake up call, care about me.
Yeah.
Because somebody could easily just say, "Fuck you, man. You're done.
Thanks, dick."
Yeah. Bye. Bye, Felicia. Right?
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. But that was the moment. And I'm not taking anything away from my parents. I know they've always loved me and cared for me. But that was truly the moment where I realized.
Yeah.
From both a leadership perspective, from a humanitarian perspective, and just an awareness perspective, you're a fucking speck.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, think about that. I mean, being a parent yourself, I'm a parent now, and I think about...
And you have great kids, by the way.
They are pretty great.
I love Carl.
Your kids are pretty great, too.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And but think about this. It's not even really so much you know, if you're going to fuck your kids up, it's how are you going to fuck your kids up?
Yeah, no, that, you know? That's perfectly said. That's yeah, exactly
because
it.
Because your parents didn't set out to go, you know, what are we going to do with this kid? They were like, ah, Jesus, all right, well, you know, he didn't catch himself on fire, but in the process of making him fear the fire, let him right out into the world with these other things.
That's perfectly said because, first of all, we all have our own hang-ups, right? So what are we going to impart on our kids?
Yeah, exactly.
You know I've done great and not so great things as far as the impression on my kids. But you know what I did? It was about, I'd probably say about 8 years ago. I realized, you know, so like Alex now, he's 22.
Yeah.
Right? And Emily's 19. I realized that my mission was never to be perfect. That being imperfect was actually okay.
Yeah.
So, like, the experiences that my kids had of me are great, not so great, terrible. I mean, the whole gamut.
Yeah.
Just like with them. My only mission with my kids, I realized this about 8 years ago, did I make good decision makers?
Yeah.
So, and I'm going to put this out there, you know, in a general sense, not directly to my kids. It's like, I don't care if you have a kid that's male, female, whatever.
Right.
They're going to do things, and I say things with quotes around them.
Yeah.
That you don't necessarily want to know about.
Sure.
But guess what? They're going to do them.
Right.
Does that matter? Nope. Can they make good decisions?
Yeah.
To me, that's the most important thing with raising kids. Because at the end of the day, I've had my successes, failures. I've been a great parent. I've been a terrible parent. The whole gamut. That's life.
Because you can worry about your kids, you know, whether or not they're going to drink or whether or not they're going to try drugs or whatever. I mean, those things are almost inevitable in the life of any kid. So you almost think to yourself, like, are they going to be smart enough to know, all right, I'm going to have two and then I'm going to stop? Or, you know,
do I need to call mom and dad?
Yeah, to get, exactly.
Yeah. So that's been my litmus test as a parent is, did I raise good decision makers? And to this date, yeah, I did. I'm proud.
Well, you know, I mean, there's still time.
Oh, yeah, they could fuck up. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. All of a sudden, it's like, you know, the Manson cult restarted and the head of the... No, I'm not going
to
say that.
Yeah, you know, and then you're on TV.
That's right.
Trying to have to explain why your kid's up in a clock tower with a manifesto.
No, I'm going to be playing this podcast. Yeah. I'm like, see, no, I was really an advocate of being a good person.
Yeah. Exactly. No, you true. Can't. You can't win in a situation like
that. No, you
that,
can't.
You know, I mean, because that's actually a really profound way to go about it. Like, how do I teach them to make good decisions when I'm not around?
Yeah. And I mean, that's all I can hope for.
Yeah, that's actually pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, they love my kids and love their talents. I love their successes and their mistakes. But at the end of the day, I'm not going to be around.
Right.
Right? So are you carrying on the human condition?
Yeah.
You know? And I do, you know, even with all the bullshit that goes on, and especially this country to this day, I still do believe in the human condition.
Yeah.
I do believe that, you know, I'm not one that believes that we're inherently evil and need some kind of crutch to elevate ourselves. No, we're inherently good. And as long as the majority of us look at how we're going to do that with the younger generations.
Yeah.
Just to remain inherently good.
Yes.
Then we succeed.
Yeah.
We may blow the shit out of us. Boom! Whoever created these things, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, it sounds like your parents were like, well, I mean, the Air Force will iron them out.
No. Actually, my parents were very supportive. I mean, again, you know, going back to...
Well, I don't mean that negatively. I just
I don't. You know. I didn't take it that way. They were... So here's my parents' philosophy, right? So my dad, by trade, was a machinist.
Mm-hmm.
I got a story to tell you about this because it was amazing for me. So working class guy.
Mm-hmm.
My mom was a homemaker growing up. my mom was Italian, my dad was Polish. The joke, by the way, goes, I'm angry, I just can't remember at who. They, as far as parents, were very supportive. But since they didn't have, like, the experience of higher education, you know, they were high school graduates. My dad went to a trade school.
Yeah.
You know? When things like when I really got into music, they were supportive. Mm-hmm. They appreciated the arts aspect of it. But when I became kind of that dickish, you know, young kid, yeah, it was beyond their experience.
Yeah.
But they never took the position of like, oh, the Air Force will straighten them out. They took the position of if that's what you want to do and if that's going to make you happy.
Yeah.
That's more important than anything else.
Sure.
So,
but it sounds like in some ways it did straighten you out.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah, I got my balls kicked in about that first audition. Yeah. Yeah. Or but not audition, but the first jury.
Isn't there something great about learning how to recover from the first time you get the shit beat out of you?
Yeah. It wasn't the only time though. I mean,
well, of course not.
No, but there was another time. So once I grew into my own, if you were, where I was comfortable with my arranging and composition skills.
Sure.
I wrote, and I will show you this. So the listening audience will never see this because it's a podcast, but I will show you this because I still have it. And it was typed, by the way. Good old typewriter. This brings it back to the late 80s to make it. I wrote a referendum on how the band should change. And it was like a 17 page. I had like stage layouts.
How old were you?
At that time, I was 22.
Oh my God.
So I actually drew stage layouts of different sizes of stages and how the band should be laid out. But I went, it, basically what it was a branding statement. I came up with this document for branding and I put it on, our non-commissioned officer in charge, who's still a good friend of mine, Don Bird, great mentor of mine, incredible musician. He was our NCO. And I put it on Don Bird's desk for him to read it in the morning. That afternoon, he called me into his office. And he goes, Chris, I want to talk to you about what you left for me this morning. I'm like, yeah, Dom, like excited, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I thought he was going to love it. I mean, I did this in pure, like, passion.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, don't ever fucking tell me how to run my band. Where do you get off? Yeah, I mean, again, got my balls kicked in. But that was another great teaching.
Take this neatly typed and pressed hubris.
Yes.
And put it back into whatever recesses you pulled this out of.
That's right. But that was, again, a moment of learning. At the time, it felt embarrassing, but it was a moment of learning. It was like, yeah, you don't do that.
Yeah.
You know? There is a time and a place. And so, like, we look at, like, any local band or any group. And in fact, take it out of bands. It's just anything that somebody has a desire to do. And it's easy to do the hard charge. Like, look how passionate I am.
Yeah.
It's not as powerful as you think. It's, you're already going to put somebody on the defensive who's in that position of evaluating, but maybe, you know, the step or two above you. It creates a perception that, you know, you're trying to usurp. Now, me personally, like in my career, I want to raise folks on my teams to take my job over.
Yeah.
It's the only way I'm going to progress, right?
Right. It reflects well on you.
If I don't have somebody behind me, right? If I don't have the succession plan in place, how can I progress?
Yeah.
You know? So, all right. I got off on a tangent on that.
Well, that's because you're a psychopath.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Let's keep on reminding.
Yeah, in everybody case anyone yes, forgot.
I'm Chris's first psychopath on the show.
No, you're not. I've been on the show, so.
Oh, yes. That's right.
I just come at it from a different angle. So funny. As far as that's concerned, I mean, you know, I think because I have seen this tendency in people quite often, and it's, you know, I man, I don't even know how this statement is going to come out of my mouth. So I'm going to try to tread carefully with it.
Just go for it.
Especially since you're sitting on the other side of the table there and there's a hammer. But,
it is.
yeah. So, what I'm thinking is, because I've seen this happen in a lot of cases, I've seen some very highly intelligent people with psychopathic tendencies, which I think is linked to that intelligence. I think that the psychopathy almost comes from a frustration with, things like, look at it this way, like you're on speed and everyone else is on heroin. And no, so there's a frustration factor that comes along with that sometimes if you're, because there's smart people and then there's really smart people. And when you've got that and you take that with you out into the world, you have your bravado rewarded a number of times. And so, of course, you've fostered those things because I'm rewarded for this. So that means I'm right. And you take all of those things, you compress it, you throw it out into the world. And then I've seen it in a number of cases where you take an individual like that and you push them through the hammer and the anvil of the armed forces. And it's almost like you didn't recognize that you had so many areas that needed to be hammered until it was like, no, we're just going to fix a couple of these things because you have a lot of things that without some sort of direction are going to be a problem for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so like my brother was very similar, highly intelligent, very, very gifted at a lot of things. A lot of stuff came very easily to him. And then he went into the army and it was like, suddenly, I don't know exactly what happened. I just know that he came out the other side able to manage himself like a person, like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I'm sure you've seen this a number of times. So like, you go into the Air Force, you've got, you're laying things on people's desk and saying, I got a better way to do this at 22. So you've definitely got some of that tendency in you still. But at the same time, I would have to imagine that discipline extends far beyond just, knowing that you've got to wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, even if you don't want to. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it extends far beyond the things that maybe a civilian would have a recollection of.
So I'm going to put this in a broader context, and I'll start with the military, because my experience in the armed forces is not, I guarantee you, the experience that your brother had.
Sure.
I was specifically, here was like the average week, month, year for me. If I was not traveling to play, I rehearsed every day.
Yeah.
Between 9 and 3. I mean, that it was a full-time musician's job.
Yeah.
So to the military experience and the kind of like chastising moments that I've described to you today, yes, that helped shape me to be more professional and be more adult. But I pretty much had a full-time music gig.
Yeah.
So the discipline, music, was already ingrained, right? So yeah. I wasn't being this little fucking, I'm typing this shit and putting it on your desk guy between right. 9 and 3 because I'm rehearsing, right?
Yeah.
So there is the aspect of that. I think, though, over time, the lessons of professionalism that I learned in the military, not because of military protocol. Listen, I had friends that were pilots.
Yeah.
Right? And we'd hang out every once in a while. We'd, go to clubs around the area we were all in. And they'd be like, dude, you have such a skate job.
Yeah.
It's such a skate job. All you do is play music. And my response was this, and I don't think this is cocky. I think it's realistic. I can learn your job in 6 months. Learn mine in the same time. and then you can talk all the shit you want.
Right.
So I had a confidence about what we did, but it was those defining moments of you're not as good as you think you are.
Right.
That became the template for lessons later in life. Because even with employees, like the first time that I managed a team, so I fell into technology and software specifically by accident. And we can talk about that later, but it was by accident. And it was a happy accident because I actually had a natural affinity toward technology and software development specifically. By the way, it's no different than writing music.
Yeah.
Writing software is just pattern recognition. It really, it's not that, yeah, I'm not going to say it's not that difficult, but that is the general gist. But I fell into that world. And when I first started managing teams, I fired off a missive one time because we were, you know, we're like 3 weeks behind our deadline to deliver this new product and it's still not functioning. And I wrote this literally a missive that wasn't, I wasn't trying to tear down anybody on the team, but I was trying to, in my thoughts, uplift them.
Yeah.
And I was like,
how did
you know,
that go for you?
If you don't have the passion to do this, and you know, like, I really love this, blah, 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 blah. And I made somebody cry the first time. My first team, I made somebody cry. And the person who I reported to wrote me a one-sentence email in response to what happened. And it was, you're never going to win a Dale Carnegie Management Award. But that's a teaching moment.
It is.
Now, going back to my tendency, when that kind of feedback comes in, you know, obviously the thicker, the skin becomes thicker over time. But when that came in, it hurt me.
Right.
I was depressed for a long time. Like, I suck. I'm mean. I'm a terrible person. You know, let's go get some lead and
right.
take
this
out. This
is what I thought I was supposed to be doing. And it's the only way I can think of to do it. And now I've been told it's wrong.
Yeah.
And I don't have an alternate.
So, but it was the lessons, you know, going back to like the armed services where I then can pull myself out of those, you know, darkened reflective moments and say, wait a minute, how do you spin this to make it right?
Yeah.
So I know my flaws. I'm pretty self-aware and I still have them, but I do try to at least ground it back to, you know, actually I had an associate that reported me for a while. He's still one of my dear friends. And he told his teams, because I basically had to lay it on the line with a bunch of different software development teams that you're off the rails here and you're costing way too much money and I want to see a plan to bring it back.
Yeah.
And a lot of people thought I was being kind of really harsh on them as the individuals. And my friend elevated, he's like, here's the thing that you have to know about Chris. Don't necessarily listen to the exact words coming out of his mouth. Find the message, and then you'll know where he is. And, you know, I actually do think that's a good way to understand me.
Yeah.
If I want to be personal, believe me, you'll know when I'm being personal. But if I say something sucks, I'm not throwing you under the bus. I'm just saying, it sucks. Let's make it better.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Yeah, to you, there's a solution at the end of that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a be-all, end-all statement.
That's right. It's not the end. There's no punctuation on it. It's a dash.
Yeah.
This sucks. Dash. Now write the rest of the story.
Yeah. It sucks here.
Yeah.
Let's make it not suck over there.
But, yeah.
So how do you take all of these things that have driven you up to this point? You know, you play music, you join the Air Force and do music there. You fall into technology and you're now writing software and putting all those things together. And you have this trajectory that takes you upward and upward and upward through these things. There's failures that teach you how to be better the next time. And then you land on a nonprofit.
Well, okay.
Explain this to
no,
me.
No, actually, there's a story. So the not-for-profit you're talking about is Sponsor You.
Yes.
And it's, we want to tackle student loan debt, right? And we'll talk about the what I'll call the special sauce about that. But it actually started in 2006. So I've been, from a technology perspective, I've been in the consumer lending world for 25 years.
Yeah.
Largely around student loan, student loans. Let's just call it that. In 2006, you know, I had a software company that I owned at that time. I was the founder of it. And we hooked up with a contract with a peer-to-peer lender. So if you don't know what peer-to-peer lending is, think Prosper if you've ever seen them.
Yeah.
It's basically, hey, I need a small loan of $2,500. And then there's like 15 people that will sign up to give you their money and they get a return on it, you know. But that was the first exposure that I had to the world of peer-to-peer lending. And I started to think to myself, I'm like, why can't we turn this around? Why don't we do peer-to-peer social pay down? Not lending.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes when you use the term capitalism, it has a negative connotation, right? So let's really break down what capitalism is. It's not about I'm rich, you're poor.
Right.
The basis of a capitalistic economy is a market-based economy. And more succinctly put, it's a consumer-driven economy. So it's up to you to keep the economy floating. And if you like a good or a service, you will pay a fair exchange for it.
Right.
If you no longer like it, you won't, and they die. Now, propping up companies, that's, you know, don't proclaim to be a capitalist, and then you're also raising your hand and saying, yeah, we should bail out the audio companies. No, they should die. That's the principle of a market-driven economy. And I'm a proponent of capitalism, a market-driven economy. You can't have that if you have slaves to debt.
Yes.
Okay? You can't, if you want a healthy economy, don't give me this bullshit about job creator. There's no such thing as a job creator.
Right.
You know what creates jobs? You go to McDonald's and buy their fries, they stay in business.
Yeah.
You don't, they die. That's what creates jobs.
Yeah.
So government, rich people, fuck that. It's a myth.
Right.
All right. So going back to the core. So 2006, I'm like, oh, this peer-to-peer lending is pretty powerful. What if we had peer-to-peer social pay down? And I came up with, and I outlined an executive summary called Edumate. That's what it was back then, Edumate. And then we had an opportunity to grow out another side of the current business that I owned, and I put it on the shelf. Well, this past summer in 2017, my cousin's son, who, again, my cousin, Jim, he just finished his junior year at Penn State. He was enrolled in the Smeal College of Business in the Entrepreneurial and Innovation Program. And he's like, Chris, can I intern with you over the summer? I'm like, sure, Jim. I'm like, what do you want to do? He goes, well, you know, I'm in this innovation and entrepreneurship program at Penn State, but I don't really know what it takes to launch a business. And you've had those experiences. So I want to know the ins and outs of like, what's it take to raise money and stuff like that. I'm like, yeah. So I flew him out to Denver for 2 months. And he started pitching me some of the ideas that he and a colleague of his at Penn State had. And no offense to Jim, they were shitty. I mean,
right.
you couldn't monetize them. There's no way they would become a business that's viable, let alone have somebody interested in giving money toward it, right? So we talked through that, and I said, let's iterate through this. And I don't remember exactly what happened in one point of conversation, but we got on the subject of student loan debt. And I'm like, Jim, do you have student loans? He goes, yeah, I'm pretty sure I do. I'm like, what do you mean you're pretty sure you do? How much do you have? He goes, I don't know. And boom, the light bulb went back off in my mind. I'm like, you are the epitome of what we're dealing with in this country now. And I said, let me tell you about this idea I came up with in 2006. So I brushed off Edumate, and we started iterating through it. And that's how Sponsor U was formed. And Sponsor U is all about crowdfunding student loan debt, but based on goal achievement. Because here's the reality. You know, why am I passionate about this? Well, because we've sold a bill of goods to our consumers in this country that, you know, first of all, everybody deserves to go to higher education. You know, when you go back to the mid-80s, you know, when I graduated high school, going into college, right?
Yeah.
Tuition, I could go to state college for $2,600 a year. That's like $26,000 a year now.
Yeah.
It's crazy, right? Yeah. And except we've sold this mission that everybody should go to post-secondary education. Get your degree. You're going to be more popular. People are going to love you. No, it's a lie. It's a lie. But we sold it, and guess how you do it? You get debt.
Debt.
So here's a stat for you. Just put it in perspective. This year, 44 million Americans have some form of student loan debt. 44 million. It's greater than 10% of our entire population. There's $1.5 trillion in outstanding federal student loan debt. Forget about private loans. That's just federal.
Yeah.
20.5 million kids were enrolled this year, 2 to 4 year degree programs. 70% of them required financial aid. And I'm not talking about scholarships and grants. Sure, there's a percentage there. I'm talking loans.
Yeah.
So that's why. So when we started going through it with Jim and he realized that he had $80,000 in student loan debt.
Yeah.
He was looking at an $800 a month payment.
Yeah.
I'm like, we should start this up. So that's how we got into it. It was just purely from an internship last summer plus an idea that was germinated 12 years ago. It just all came together like a perfect storm. And over the past year, we've built the platform. We have our minimally viable product already out in the wild. We have 200 students that are on the platform, you know, but we're handholding them right now because we know we're beta.
Yeah.
But no, it's a crisis, Chris. That's it.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, how the idea came about, regardless of the convergence of the time and circumstance and the previous ideation, it's now like real. It's like, okay, now let's go ahead and solve this.
Yeah.
And we're not trying to like pay off student loan debt, right? So we want debt relief, but it's goal-based. It's achievement-based. So if you think you're going on a GoFundMe type platform and saying, oh, I'm going to raise $25,000, pay off student loans. All right, then use GoFundMe. That's not what we do monthly sponsorship contributions. Our whole model is based on trying to connect people through the model of social pay down.
Yeah.
So create a mentorship network. So we're inviting like alumni organizations, employers. If you know, you're part of a Greek organization, the national chapter of the Greek organizations, the students themselves, we're trying to elevate it to say, a way I've always kind of illustrated it is this way, Chris. Imagine going to Vegas with $100,000.
Yeah.
Slapping it down on a craps table and then telling, you know, the dealer at the craps table, hey, I'll be back in a week. Tell me how I did. That's what we're doing with education, though, these days.
Yeah.
These kids are taking out tons of debt.
Yeah.
And not even realizing it in the majority of cases or not appreciating it. And then waking up after the party saying, what happened?
Yeah.
How did this happen? I'm shackled. Well, it's an investment, kids. And you would not do that. You would not do that in Vegas. You would not do that with Wall Street. But you're doing it with your futures right now. So the least that we can try to do is build community and connection around the problem, but also make you aware of this is what you're looking at.
Yeah.
And you better look at options, because guess what? The old standbys of doctors and lawyers, that's your degree. You're not going to be promised $150,000 a year anymore.
Right.
You know, actually we literally need more ditch diggers these days. Shit, with the fucking traffic around Denver, man, clearly they don't have enough help.
Yeah.
Endless construction. What the hell, man? Yeah. I hope that answered your question. I was long-winded answer. But.
It sounds like you found a way to actually do something thinking about the plight of other people.
Yeah, well, it concerns me. And again, yeah. Going back to the little diatribe about
capitalism. See, you're not a sociopath.
No, I'm a psychopath. Which
is different.
That's yeah. Right. You know, going back to the
that's whole... a pretty good exclamation point at the end of that idea, though, right?
You're going back to the aspect of, you know, a consumer-driven economy.
Yeah.
I do want people, whether it's right or wrong for the period of time, and I'm not going to judge this, but I do want people to think about starting a family and buying a house and buying a car. You can't do that. You know, if you're walking out of school with $40,000 in student loan debt, guess what's going to be put on hold?
All of it.
A whole bunch for the majority.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are the people that aren't affected by that, either have no debt. Like with my kids, they really don't have any debt. But that was a conscious decision that we made as parents that said, you know, we're going to do this.
Yeah.
Not everybody's afforded that.
Sure.
And, you know, when you have a student loan payment that's greater than my car payment, holy shit.
Yeah.
How are you going to think about anything else?
You know? Yeah.
You got a boat anchor around your head. So, yeah, we have to solve it. I mean, here's the most ridiculous statistic about the whole thing. $1.5 trillion. The U.S. Department of Education is the largest lender, and they're not even a lender.
That's crazy.
Yeah. It's depressing.
Well, I guess we're in the right place for it.
Yeah, I'll have another cup of coffee now. Thank you.
Well, thanks for talking to me, Chris.
Oh, well, I hope you found this was enjoyable.
Absolutely,
I do. I love the headphones. They sound great.
And we'll see you out there.
Thank you. Who are you? You're like Art Bell. You ever listen to Art Bell?
Yeah.
Okay. Love him. Sorry he's dead.
Rest in peace, Art Bell.
Yeah, happens to people. All right, thanks.
Well, what did I tell you? The moment you start scratching below the surface on a human being, it's like getting that metal stuff flaked off on the lottery ticket. You never have any idea what you're going to get underneath, but it's going to be something. Are you going to win $5, $100, or a free bookmark? A free bookmark is pretty good. I recommend you go out and get yourself a book. As a matter of fact, Adam Caton Holland just wrote a book, and you should check that out. But enough about that. This is the end of the show, where I start going off on something. Did I mention I'm a little punchy this week? Make sure you check out Chris's band, The Unfriended, on Facebook, and most importantly, live around Denver, because they're the best damn punk cover band in the area. And don't kill yourself out there. Get some sleep. I'm going to do the same.